Conditions, they are bad, and some of you are sad. You cannot see your enemy, the class that lives in luxury. You working folk are poor, will be forevermore. As long as you permit the few to guide your destiny, shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty. The master class is small, but they have lots of gall. When we unite to gain our right, if they resist, we'll use our might. There is no middle ground. This fight must be one round to victory for liberty. Our class is marching on. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty. Working folk unite, we must put up a fight to make us free from slavery and capitalistic tyranny. This fight is not in vain, we've got a world to gain. Will you be a fool, a capitalist tool, and serve your enemy? Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty.
Greetings, listeners and fellow workers. I'm fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I live in Bremerton, but I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. And we want to introduce you to the rest of the participants sitting around the table. And we'll start with fellow worker Noah.
Hi, my name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I've been part of the Tacoma branch of the IWW since March of 21. I've had a lot of great work working with this union branch so far, and I'm proud to be part of a workers' organization.
Hello, I'm Marilyn, fellow worker Marilyn. I use she, they pronouns. I'm a delegate. If anybody out there would like to join our branch, I can sign you up. I've been a member since about 2008, and it all matters. I'm glad to be a member of the IWW.
All righty.
Hello, my name is Alan. I joined the IWW in sometime in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Been a member of the Tacoma branch off and on ever since. And he, him is good for me.
My name is Lynn, she, her. I'm from a union family, a longshoreman, several relatives. I've been in several unions through the years. IWW is my union now, and we're known as the Wobblies, so Wob Radio, that explains that. I'm the treasurer of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. Anyway, I'm happy to be part of this radio enterprise.
Thank you so much. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what the IWW is?
Sure. The Industrial Workers of the World started out in 1905, specifically in opposition to the craft union movement, which was the AFL at the time. The IWW is a revolutionary union. We believe that we have to dismantle capitalism and we have to replace it with industrial democracy, as we put it. And so the union also organizes horizontally, meaning that we're not a top-down outfit, we're a bottom-up outfit, meaning that we're democratically controlled. All of our officers are unpaid, except, I think, for the General Secretary Treasurer, but, you know, in Chicago. But we have no paid business reps, no paid stewards. We elect everybody, and we can recall anybody who we think is not doing a good enough job. So it's very democratically controlled, which is a lot different from your traditional AFL-CIO unions. So our goal is to replace capitalism and build a new world within the shell of the old.
Thank you so much. And fellow worker Lynn, you were going to read us a couple sections of the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW.
Yes, fellow worker Noah. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed and the interest in the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. We are known for that phrase, by the way. Instead of the conservative motto, quote, a fair day's wage for fair day's work, unquote, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Lynn. Go ahead and start off the radio show. We have quite a lineup of labor news today. We have a couple big updates here locally in the Pacific Northwest. The first I'd like to start off with, the Home in Tacoma for All campaign. To any of our fellow listeners who tuned in previously, the Home in Tacoma for All campaign, which is also known as Tacoma for All, basically put forward a ballot initiative several months ago with the support of several of thousands of signees to get on the...
8,000 to be more than 8,000 to be precise.
So there's an initiative on the ballot with more than 8,000 signatures behind it that meant to expand protections for renters. Now, what the city council did, assumedly under the pressure of the local landlords and housing investors, was to create a doppelganger initiative onto the same ballot coming up in the upcoming local elections in November, basically providing some of the same renters' protections, but it wasn't as broad and encompassing.
Well, the thing is, Noah, in that city council meeting where they came up with their doppelganger, they voted as city council to adopt it. So it was no longer an initiative. It already was law.
Okay.
And then they turned around and wanted to put it on the ballot for the voters so as to confuse the voters. So Ann Dorn and Democratic Socialists of America, the Tacoma branch, sued the city council and took it to court. And the judge that was hearing it was Judge Ashcroft. Many blessings upon his head. It took a while and it took lots of different sessions, but the ruling finally came down that the city could not do that, that they were misleading the public and they could not put their opposing ballot on the ballot, their opposing measure on the ballot, because it was not actually up for a vote. It already was law. So score one for the good guys.
Absolutely. And this is kind of one of those rare wins, although they seem to be mounting lately, where there's this big working class push to, say, have better renters' protections or make it easier for employees to unionize. Whereas in this situation, it was a, you know, pretty powerful authority figure, a judge, a municipal judge, actually telling the city council instead of the workers, like, hey, actually, no, you did put something on the ballot that was confusing, and this is going to be harmful to voting because it's not representative of what it actually is.
Right.
So,
who made that ruling?
Judge Ashcroft.
Okay.
This is a pretty big ruling because I think it kind of opens the doors for other renters' protections as well.
Well, it certainly closed the door for the city's tactic of first adopting something and then trying to put it in front of the voters.
Right.
Now, they tried something similar to that with the $15 an hour minimum wage initiative that fellow worker Sarah Morgan spearheaded with the Socialist Alternatives. And when they found that she was getting enough signatures to put it on the ballot, they quickly came up with a competing measure, and they got away with that. But they didn't first sit in council and adopt it.
$3 less an hour.
So, I'm sure that the city has learned from this. We need to be careful. They will never do that particular stunt again, but the battle goes on. They will try other ways to foil popular initiatives that people want a chance to vote on.
Parliamentary obfuscation.
Yeah.
I think that I think the other context of this, too, is that the city, like you said, the city council has a habit of doing this. A lot of other city councils have a habit of doing this as well, because they're able to find these legal loopholes of, well, we can introduce this as a ballot initiative, even though we've already voted on it and made it law, because there's a more competitive initiative that's actually gaining a lot of steam that might be more harmful to...
Yeah, they won't do it quite like that. They'll have a different way of going around it. So we need to be alert and keep our eyes open and keep our hands on the steering wheel.
It's definitely a win for grassroots organizing as well. I know that the Tacoma Democratic Socialists, as well as a bunch of local labor unions, endorsed this and really literally put in the footwork to gather signatures, verify that they're all correct, make sure it was submitted on time, make sure that the initiative was written correctly. They put a lot of effort into this.
Now what we need to do, the landlords are putting millions of dollars into TV ads and campaigns to try to convince people not to vote for this. We need to do everything possible, whether it's doorbelling now even more than before, whether it's donating to the organizations that are trying to get the word out to deconfuse what the situation is. People need to really activate now, because we could go down under the weight of the other side's money.
Right. Well,
is it going to be on the ballot?
Yes.
Even though the judge ruled it shouldn't be?
No, ours will be on the ballot, but people might vote against it, because now that's what the opposition is going to do. They're going to say, don't vote for this. And they're going to still try to confuse people. They will say, oh, the city council already voted for a really good measure. You don't need this now. So they're not going to give up.
Right. There's still a couple months before the election actually happens. And like what Marilyn said, they can put out as much ad and as much of a ruckus about this as possible to try and dissuade voters.
I think I heard somewhere that they've already put up $180 million to make this go down. Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's unreal. And little Tacoma.
Well, because
it's the Landlords Association.
That and the effects of local politics will affect you harder than anything that occurs on a national level, unless it's something the size of like the New Deal in 1934.
Right. To amplify on that, if I might, sometimes our union gets criticized because we seem to be straying away from labor organizing, specifically at the workplaces. However, this is illustrative of the intersection between local politics and renters and workers, because most workers are renters, and vice versa.
Many are.
Many are.
Younger workers are renters.
Especially, right. Yes. What I'm getting at is that, yes, this is not strictly workplace organizing. However, it does impact the economic well-being and the social well-being of the working class.
Yes. So that's the current update with the Home in Tacoma for All campaign. We will be getting a couple of those organizers on the radio really soon. Anne and Ty, I want to get them on the radio because I think that the story of how this happened from their perspective is absolutely fascinating. And it just kind of gives you a glimpse into, even though there are these medium and small towns that you think will be covered by these larger legal protections, the governments of those small towns or medium-sized towns like Tacoma do try and interfere when the working class gets a little too rowdy. So I'm going to have them on the radio soon. Please keep an eye out for that, listener.
And in the spirit of inoculation, what I want to tell the listener, in case they have a unit upstairs that they're renting out or something like that, this initiative that will be on the ballot is for larger landlords. It is not for the person who rents a room in their house or rents their upstairs. They exempt the truly small landlords. What it's aimed at is the giant developers that come down here from Seattle and kick people out of their apartments so they can completely rebuild them and charge 2 and 3 times the rent. That's what this is about.
Absolutely. The UAW is currently gearing up for a historic auto industry strike.
There is so much happening in labor news right now.
Which one did they pick? Last time they struck GM, General Motors. This time I think they're going for a Ford truck plant.
I believe so.
Down in Kentucky, I think.
So this article is coming from the Northwest Labor Press. This is one of our favorite websites that we'd like to report from, because not only is it Northwest focused, but it's also very working class and union oriented. UAW gearing up for historic auto industry strike. This was posted on August 24th, 2023. Auto workers are quite likely heading for a strike that could shut down the American automobile industry if executives at the big three U.S. automakers balk at giving them a fair contract. And fair to the United Auto Workers, the UAW, means undoing concessions that were agreed to by previous union leaders and giving workers a share of the company's recent record-busting profits. The big three are General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. Stellantis was created in the 2021 merger of Fiat Chrysler Automobiles and the French PSA Group. It owns the U.S. auto brands Chrysler, Jeep, and Dodge. Contracts for all three expire at midnight on September 14th and cover roughly 150,000 workers in all. Together, the three companies made $21 billion in profit in the first 6 months of 2023 and $250 billion over the last 10 years. Record profits mean record contracts, said UAW President Sean Fain in an August 1st Facebook Live event with UAW members. The top priority of Fain, who was elected UAW president in March of 2023, as head of a slate of officer candidates committed to reversing concessions made by the previous UAW leadership. His election means the leadership caucus that led UAW for 70 years is out of power. In fact, two former UAW presidents are now in prison.
Yay!
So, the current demands are end two-tier wages and benefits.
Yes.
Restore the defined benefit pension and retiree health care for all workers.
Yes.
Increase wages 46% over 4 years.
Hell yes.
Restore cost of living raises. Increase pension benefits for the first time since 2003 and restore retiree medical benefits. Establish a 32-hour work week. Ding, 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 ding. The 4-hour work week is gaining traction in this country. Make all current temps permanent employees and secure the right to strike over plant closures.
So this guy's is a huge some slate. Guts.
Yes, and this could potentially go into effect on the 14th.
Wow.
A strike of about 120,000 workers across the country.
Oh, my goodness.
Once again, just to illuminate this, this is another example of grassroots movement among the rank and file in these big traditional unions that we all know about. The Teamsters at UPS is a direct result of Teamsters for a Democratic Union getting that reform slate elected. UAW used to be one of the most radical CIO unions in the country. They invented pretty much the sit-down strike at Flint and other places back in the 30s. Now, they've been compromised over the years, and the newer workers, the younger workers, they're just taking matters into their own hands. They're electing these reform slates to the leadership of these unions, and more power to them. Just a shout out to the IWW. We were first. We were the first union to promote direct action and to also promote, we don't necessarily need a contract. We can take direct action and get what we need to live.
Absolutely. This is yet another, I mean, just covering labor news over the past few months, there have been several possible strikes. Instead of just, you know, 40 to 60,000 workers at best, now it's getting into the six-digit range, which is also really surprising because the rail workers, you know, we talked a lot of steam about them getting busted. That was only about 60,000 workers. I mean, a very critical industry. But now we're having strikes of, you know, UPS threatened to strike with 360,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now with the Teamsters, the UAW is now threatening to strike with 120,000. It's fascinating to watch because these sizes of strikes haven't occurred in well over 70 years for a reason.
If the postal workers went out, how many would that be?
I mean, that's probably easily 100,000 max. And that's just a conservative estimate off the top of my head, because you also have to think of everybody else that works in conjunction who might also be organized and might also go on strike as well for similar reasons, just like with the UPS workers. So, yeah, this is pretty big. And this would also affect the Pacific Northwest as well, because I know that we have some pretty big harbors here that offload cars, often prep them for transport to dealerships or to have modifications or repairs done. So if these big three auto industries, if their workers go on strike, it would be a shutdown to the automobile industry in this country for however long that they need to. That's pretty fascinating. And these demands are like they said, this is something that's been 70 years in the making. This needed to happen a long time ago. And compromises were made by the union leadership of that time that should not have been made.
Yeah, I can't think of anything worse for worker morale than being on the same assembly line or in the same on the same shop floor, and your next door neighbor at their workstation is getting half your wages. This creates friction in and of itself amongst the workers. And it's interesting to note that some of the older workers who are on that first tier are among the hardest fighters, because they have sons and daughters too. And they have, you know, people who need to enter into a decent paying working class job.
I would also like to argue that a lot of those older workers who have been in the industry for a long time have those good wages and benefits because they know the value of fighting for them.
Exactly.
And what to do to fight for them. And this is just, you know, the last bit of the article here from Northwest Labor Press. Speaking of fighting, the UAW has more than $825 million in its strike fund, which it pays a stipend to members so they can survive while on strike. And convention delegates regularly voted to increase strike pay to $500 a week, up from $275 a week previously. Strike pay starts after the eighth day of a striker lockout. So if it makes it to day eight, they have this huge pool of funds in order to make sure that those workers don't suffer while they're on strike.
Excuse me, we may see about that. If you consider the mine workers, they were on strike.
For a long time.
The union bosses starved them to go back to work.
Yeah.
If you're making between $75,000 and $100,000 a year, all of a sudden you're now getting $200 a week. I mean, that's not going to cover your mortgage, much less shoes for your kids, you know. I mean,
right. So this is, I mean, to kind of make the distinction between the mine workers union and this union sounds like it's becoming a lot more militant and its leadership are actually being threatened by the rank and file. Whereas I think with the mine workers union, that leadership was pretty entrenched and was willing to make those compromises because they were afraid of pissing off the people they made contracts with. So there's a difference in attitude here, and it kind of is all the more the reason to, you know, ensure that your union really is a rank and file, like Gordon said, from the bottom up organization. Because the mine workers were a failure of top down, you're going to do this or you're going to have to go back to work. So, you know, this strike might start on the 14th, which today is the 2nd. That's 12 days from this episode will be up before they go on strike. So hopefully the workers get what they want. As always in the IWW, we support workers whenever they're on strike or they're asking for better wages, hours, and conditions. I think this might be a pretty easy win for them if it comes to effect, though. The auto industry can't deal with that kind of blow to their production.
It's very good to know that the spirit of militant unionists is being rekindled in some of these mainstream unions, and it just brings joy to my heart, even though they're copying the IWW, but we'll let it.
Hey, we're passing on our values
there
to the generation, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
And I've been seeing this coming for a while. You know, there used to be this tension between Pierce County Labor Council and IWW that we were kind of shoved to the side. But the last couple of times that we've met at Ralph Chaplin's gravesite for Labor Day, there have been people that specifically mentioned and promoted industrial unionism. So it's becoming mainstream again, and it should be.
Here's a little news flash. I have contact with the Whatcom Skagit branch up in Bellingham and in Mount Vernon, and they have been given a seat at the table for Whatcom County Central Labor Council. Also, the firefighters union in Bellingham donated $500 to the IWW Monument Fund for our monument unveiling this November.
That's
down
great.
In Centralia. Yeah, it's pretty amazing because firefighters are not well known for their progressive politics, but those guys up there, they even put the IWW on their reader board out in front of their headquarters. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is.
I don't think they have a vote yet.
No, they do not have a vote.
They can give input to the meetings, and they're sitting at the table with the other mainstream labor leaders. So, yeah.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
I'd like to clarify for the listener. Militant, does that involve violence, you know, weapons?
I mean, if I wanted to be snarky, militancy, especially in the earlier labor organizing, definitely got to that point. You think of the Coal Mountain Wars in Virginia and the Appalachians. You think of the Battle of Blair Mountain. You think of the, you know, Centralia tragedy, all that stuff. Like
1934 in Minneapolis. Teamsters strike.
I don't think the unions will start forming militias again. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we really reached that level of labor conflict. Fingers crossed. But I think in terms of militancy, what we're talking about is practicing solidarity in everything that you do. Even if that means potentially risking your job, you and your coworkers sticking up for you in case you incur that kind of risk. You know, potentially going to jail if you're on strike. You know, sit-down strikes are unfortunately now legal. Mm-hmm. You and your coworkers decide to do a sit-down strike. Well, you're probably going to end up in handcuffs. But the point of militancy is to say, we will do whatever it takes in order to get our demands met. Violence is always the last option on that list. But historically, when it comes to labor conflicts, especially more often in the past than in the present, that is an aspect of it. And, you know, at least as I've in my journeys in the IWW, I've spoken to many fellow workers who are like, yeah, the violence is tragic, but when it's between your job and your family and your children and your savings and the entire rest of your life at the hands of your employer, it might not be unreasonable in the case of a Blair Mountain situation that, yeah, maybe the Pinkerton agents murdering your coworkers, one would be tempted to buy a revolver. So... yeah, and from a historical aspect, there's always been some aspect of militancy leading to violence in the labor movement, but I think when we speak of militancy in the modern day, we're talking about sticking up for each other no matter the cost.
I would hearken to the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. They were militant. They marched. They stuck together. They faced down state troopers. They faced down attack dogs. So that's a form of militancy. It's pretty much radical solidarity.
Yep.
I think when it comes to violence, we have to remember the other side has bigger weapons and more weapons than we do.
Oh, yes.
And it's, I think, rarely, if at all, violence is initiated by working people. Mm-hmm. It's the hired thugs from the other side.
The Pinkertons, the security guards, well, National Guard.
The cops.
Look at what happened to the people who were protesting a pipeline in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They hired a private security firm that sicked dogs on the people.
Yeah, and that was under the Obama administration at the time,
I know,
too.
Liberal, progressive, you know, that kind of label.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is that they fully utilized militant solidarity to try to get their aims met. And they brought people in from all over the political spectrum and all over the country to stand up on their side to fight the oil pipeline people.
Yeah.
Including veterans.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it'd actually be fascinating to have a roundtable discussion about this for our next episode, because I think that we could probably go deeper into what does militancy historically mean versus what aspects of it do we embrace now, and are there any aspects that need to come back, you know? But yeah, no, UAW is doing great. 120,000 workers might go on strike, and they have a very long list of demands that the auto industry can afford. So all of our solidarity and all of our, you know, hearts out to them. And for our last labor news story today that we'd like to talk about, the Providence Hospital System has settled with their nurses on strike. This is also from Northwest Labor Press. This was posted August 24th, 2023. The Oregon Nurses Association, the ONA, reached tentative agreements August 11th on new union contracts covering nurses and clinicians at Providence Portland and Providence Seaside. Those are two of the three bargaining units that held a five-day strike in June. If ratified, the agreements would provide significant pay raises, more time off, and safer staffing. The ONA currently represents 1,400 nurses at Providence Portland, 100 nurses at Providence Seaside, and 400 nurses and clinicians at Providence Home Health and Hospice. On June 19th through 23rd, these three units held Oregon's first nurses' strike in nearly two decades. Richard Botterill, the chair of the union bargaining committee at Providence Portland, said the strike strengthened the union by building solidarity between the nurses and the clinicians, and it showed how other Providence staff and most patients supported the union's fight. Botterill suspects that the strike didn't lead to an immediate agreement precisely because hospital executives didn't want a settlement to look like an acknowledgement that Providence mishandled the situation. Under the tentative agreement with Providence Portland, nurse wages will increase between 17% and 27% over 2 years on average. Mm-hmm. Seaside nurses will see wages increase 14% to 20% on average, depending on which nursing unit they work for. Both agreements also add 20 hours of paid time off each year of the contract, and they introduce language to set and enforce safe staffing methods. For example, under the Providence-Portland agreement, the hospital would start a pilot program to add break nurses to 8 units. Those nurses would cover patients for other nurses at lunch or on break, so no one will have to double up on patients while another nurse rests, which is a pretty big deal in the hospital industry right now. Mm-hmm. They're currently facing a pretty significant nurse and staff shortage. From what I've heard anecdotally from my friends who are nurses who work in a variety of hospitals, they've often had to deal with that doubling up situation where they briefly have to cover somebody else's patients for the day, or at least while they're on break, which leads to one nurse having 6 or 7 patients to look over, which could become a deadly situation if you have someone crash or whose health deteriorates.
So this is a tentative agreement, right?
Yes, it is a tentative agreement. The unions of both Portland and Seaside still have to ratify this.
Could you mention the name of the union again?
This is the
Oregon Nurses Association.
Yes, the Oregon Nurses Association, also known as the ONA.
Yeah, now Al was a psychiatric nurse.
Yes.
For years and years.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this?
Nurses should get paid more.
Yes, yeah. Nurses need better staffing.
Did you have to double up when people went on break?
We don't say graveyard in the hospital, so I worked night shift.
Okay.
And our patients, our clients were probably asleep.
Okay.
So when you took your half hour break for lunch, it was okay.
Yeah. Chances are good things wouldn't be going to hell in a handbasket while your back was turned.
But
yeah.
I do want to add one thing that concerns me. In terms of staffing, there is a nursing shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses are often required to work doubles, 2 shifts.
Mm-hmm.
As a medications nurse, I did a little research and found out that by the time your first shift is coming to an end, more mistakes were made in the dispensing of drugs.
Yeah.
When a medications nurse does a double, the rate of mistakes goes way up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a threat to people's safety.
Yeah.
Should not have to happen.
It's surprising that, you know, a lot of the nurses I've spoken to who are currently at part of the workforce, you know, they're working 12 to 14 hour shifts, which is similar in time to the work that I do. But, you know, you can imagine, especially if you're a night shift nurse, it just becomes exhausting. And like you said, errors are more likely to be made if you can't think straight, if you don't have rest, if you don't get time to eat something. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, the way that nursing is currently set up, it's a situation that's destined to become dangerous. Yes, fellow worker, then?
Well, I was thinking that besides being dangerous for the patients, it's also could be threatening to be a career ender for a nurse that's convicted of, you know, giving the wrong medication, especially if more than one instance.
Good point.
And so, you know, she'd have
this
a hard time.
This is a perfect example of an injury to one is an injury to all.
Mm-hmm.
If nurses are injured by having to work extra hours, extra long hours, and are at risk of making mistakes and ruining their careers, and conversely, patients are at risk of being on the receiving end of mistakes. So that's why solidarity is so important all across.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of legal cases, there was a nurse last year who got tried, and I believe she managed to avoid prison, but she was part of a surgical unit and accidentally gave a paralytic without the proper equipment for a patient that was going into surgery. So the patient asphyxiated and died because the medicine, she accidentally dispensed the wrong medicine and they died on the operating table because they weren't properly set up to keep that person oxygenated while they were unconscious and had a paralytic. So that nurse, I believe she had her license revoked, but she managed to avoid prison time because of the extenuating circumstances of working long shifts, not clear communication because people are trying to figure out what patients are supposed to be covering where. And a lot of nurses, including nurses unions, actually rallied behind that woman because she did accidentally kill someone, But on the other hand, nursing is such a stressful and detail-oriented and, you know, hectic often profession that those mistakes can happen. So even though she lost her ability to work in medicine ever again, the nurses rallied behind her and said, we're not going to let the hospitals or the administration getting away with putting one person in prison because their procedures caused this situation by extent.
Good scapegoat. Point.
Yeah. No, that was an awful, awful case.
So that's Providence.
Mm-hmm. In Oregon. The nurse specifically from that legal case was, I believe, down south in another hospital.
So each Providence, like Providence up here in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
they're not really affiliated with each other. They don't get the same benefits. It's only in Oregon.
I believe this is a workplace by workplace kind of contract arrangement because, like they said, the raises that were tentatively agreed upon were different for each bargaining unit, whether that was at Portland or at Seaside. So they do have different contracts, even though they are in the same union.
Yeah, it says Oregon Nurses Association.
Right. So hopefully they vote for that. It seems like the raises are pretty good, and like we said, they are getting the staffing adjustments that they need so that they can care for their patients properly. And that's something that a lot of nurses are currently struggling with right now. Coming out of labor news here, we have our roundtable discussion today, and we kind of wanted to jump off a little bit on the previous conversation that we had earlier in this episode, which is talking about what militancy is, how it actually works when workers flex those muscles of solidarity, and what the kind of modern day tactics of that look like. As I've said before, militancy is something that's very flexible as a definition. It's something that I hear a lot in the current environment of organized labor. A lot of people want the old-timey militancy of the early IWW or the early auto workers organizing or the timber workers and things like that. Yeah, but I think that there's kind of a loss of definition there. So when you hear the word militancy, what do you all think?
Well, like I said before, it's revolutionary solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's being able to come together as a group and stick up for one another and stick up for other workers. And that's kind of an intangible. It's a spirit. You get into things like two- or three-tier wage systems, that tears solidarity apart. And so try to organize against that. Some people think that militancy means taking up arms or forming a militia or something of that order. But it isn't. Militancy is a spirit. It's a feeling that together we stand. And if we start arguing amongst ourselves, we're going to be divided and we're not going to get what we need to live.
Absolutely. When I think of the word militancy, I mean, yeah, like you said, that iconography of forming a militia or wearing a military uniform or like going into combat is kind of what the word suggests off the face of it. But from my experiences, talking with other people who are organizing their workplaces or interested in organizing their workplaces, like you said, it is a radical solidarity of how much risk are you willing to take?
Right.
I think a lot of the labor movement up until the past couple of decades was really lenient towards having militancy because the unions didn't want to take that risk. Labor law came into place that kind of prevented that kind of militancy in the workplace, such as sit-down strikes, obviously industrial sabotage. You can go all the way back to the 1920s with criminal syndicalism laws that were, you know, targeted towards the IWW in specific, as well as a handful of other unions. I think the biggest show of militancy, to kind of give it some kind of picture or definition, is the willingness to go on strike has become bigger than ever. Obviously, we like to say in the IWW and many other unions, you know, the strike is the most powerful weapon you have. It's a deprivation of your labor from your boss because that's what they pay you for and that's what they need from their workers. I think the fact that people are more and more willing to take on the personal, financial, even mental risk of going on strike and potentially losing their employment or facing other repercussions for it, that's militancy to me. It's willing to take it, it's willing to escalate your tactics and your agreements with your coworkers in order to get what you need, is definitely kind of what I've seen over the past few years. Yeah.
I think not taking the fools lightly, not letting what people say just go unremarked, standing up for your rights and speaking your truth to power. That's part of militancy.
Absolutely. I remember mentioning in a previous episode, we were talking about this with environmental unionism as well. Mm-hmm. Do you remember me mentioning a book by Andreas Malm called How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
Yeah.
That to me, at least from the perspective of the environmentalist movement and the environmental labor movement, specifically green unionism like we've mm-hmm. talked about, that to me is kind of where the direction of militancy is going. I think a lot of these unions and a lot of their new leadership want to bring back the tactics of escalation because that did work. That is where a lot of unions got mm-hmm. their strength and got their power and influence. And so I think that there was a 50-year period of time where being willing to escalate beyond even a strike just kind of became unthinkable. It became too radical. It became too damaging to these mm-hmm. big organizations with big, big money that were unwilling to spend it on taking that risk. Whereas now, you know, it's not just workers going on strike. There are even cases of industrial sabotage going back. In the case of the environmentalist movement, instead of, you know, spraying orange paint on your local car dealership, there was that one protest by tens of thousands of German environmentalists who took over a coal field for, I want to say it was like 48 hours or something like that, until they were pushed out by the police. It's about an escalation of tactics in order to ensure that you and the person next to you are getting what they deserve out of life.
I had an opportunity to do an interview with those German people 2 years ago. They mm-hmm. contacted me, God knows why, and wanted to ask me about our civil disobedience down at the LNG plant. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they weren't ready to do anything as militant as that.
Right.
And I told them what we did and why we did it. And they were just kind of moaning and groaning at the time. Oh, well, we can't do this and we can't do that. Well, they found their feet and they did it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Took a couple years, but they did it.
Yeah. Mm. I think that when it comes to fostering militancy or growing a more militant mindset amongst organized workers, I think that there is a lot of inoculation that I think needs to be done.
Oh, yeah.
As much as we like to idolize in labor circles and working class circles, the conflicts of Blair Mountain or the Centralia tragedy in the IWW or other, you know, actual violent conflicts between labor and the bosses, you do need to kind of inoculate against two things in my mind. One is that that is going to happen. A lot of times labor disputes never get to that point unless something has gone seriously wrong. But I think another thing to inoculate on is you have to be willing to take those risks as the weaker party in that arrangement. It's the workers who take the risks on the job. It's the workers who take the biggest risks when they go on strike. Like, there's nothing pretty about, like, what we mentioned with the mine workers, you know, they're at the time labor leadership essentially screwing them over and saying, we're only going to give you this tiny paycheck, either go back to your job or quit this, you know, quit the job and lose your union membership entirely. That is a possibility. And I think that there is an opportunity for good inoculation work saying, hey, this is a reality that might happen. You need to be ready to accept that if you want better wages, hours, and conditions.
Just to clarify a term, you'll hear us talk about, we have a mnemonic, A-E-I-O-U, fellow worker Noah spelled that out over a series of episodes. And just to refresh your memory, the I part of that phrase is inoculation. And inoculation is a process in which you're honest with the employees that you're organizing with and say, this could happen. We could all get fired. It's a possibility that we could be locked out. It's a possibility that this, that, or the other thing can happen. That way you're being honest with your fellow workers, and people are definitely more prepared. If people go out on strike, they're pretty desperate anyway. They're only going out on strike because they have to. They need better pay and benefits and more time off or safety, like for the railroads. Those workers are being squeezed. You know, they're trying to make a one-man crew for a mile-long train, which is absurd on the face of it, but it's all about profit. So when we say inoculate, what we're talking about is just telling people what could possibly happen. That way they're mentally prepared and they don't get blindsided when they get a termination notice if they're out on strike.
Or resentful.
Mm-hmm. Right. That they had nothing to do, that they had no input. See, that's why a lot of the unions have been failing over the past quarter century at least, is that they were so used to giving in to the employer, and they're not democratically elected. Your stewards aren't democratically chosen. You can't recall your officers, you know. So it's BS, really. The protections are there for the business reps and for the stewards, not for the rank and file. So, you know, that's part of the problem, is being able to reasonably and rationally assess all the risks and all the benefits of any kind of action on the job.
I'd like to also bring up a note that fellow worker Lynn made previously in this episode, which is, what is the relationship with militancy and violence, especially when it comes to labor disputes or the history of organized labor?
I'm glad
labor.
You brought that up.
Here's the thing. Poverty is an act of violence. Exactly. Homelessness is an act of violence. A lack of health care that's affordable is an act of violence. We don't see that violence until it happens to us personally. And I think that the idea of, you know, oh, those labor unions, they used to be so radical and militant and violent. You know, they used to shoot it out with Pinkertons in the streets. And it's like, yeah, that's because it was allowed to get to that desperate of a situation by the business owners who were inflicting their own violence on the workers by letting them die in mines, letting them inhale dangerous fumes in factories and fields, and dying from chemical exposure. Workers face the gross amount of violence in this country at the hands of their employers in ways that they are taught not to recognize as violence.
Right.
So when it comes to, you know, a situation as bad as, say, the Battle of Blair Mountain, and people say, well, gosh, I really hope we don't ever get to that point, my retort is always, well, look at the employers. Are they willing to let it go to that point in the first place? Because at the end of the day, these people are only here for profit. It's the workers that have to remind them that they're living human beings that are making that money for them in the first place. So I obviously don't advocate violence as a method of labor organizing or as a strike tactic. But in terms of labor history, I will go on to say that sometimes that violence was necessary. The Battle of Blair Mountain was probably one of the most emblematic lessons of early labor history, because it was a time when all of those workers gathered together in solidarity and said, we're either going to die in the mine or we're going to die on this mountain. And at least if we die on this mountain, there's a chance that our spouses, that our children, that all of our other workers that work with us in the mines might have a better life worth living. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. So,
well, and there also there's a distinction between violence toward a living thing and violence toward a mechanical or a structural or a building thing.
Right.
And there is quite a split in people's attitudes about whether it's violence, militant violence, if you harm a pipeline.
Right.
Versus harm a human being.
Right.
And I'll let the listener decide a lot of that, because those are both valid points of view, that you don't want to ever damage property because it's bad PR for your cause, or you need to do that kind of action because there is such peril and risk involved,
right,
that it must be dismantled.
There is no such thing as violence towards profits and machinery, essentially. Andrea's mom actually, in that book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, very specifically said, I don't want to see the environmentalist movement get to a point where we start killing oil executives, but we need to do some kind of escalatory violence towards the machinery of that industry by either, you know, sit-down strikes or blocking construction and production, things like that. He specifically advocated for that kind of industrial violence, in quotations.
You know, back when
regarding,
we had the...
Regarding the book, they made a movie of it.
How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
Uh-huh.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, I think they showed it at the Grand.
Ooh. I'm thinking of the WTO demonstrations in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
How some of the backlash of that, although a lot of wonderful gains were made by that whole thing, the press focused almost exclusively on damage to small business owners that were not really the target.
Yes.
And so we need to be very astute in protecting small businesses that are not really part of our target.
Right, right. A lot of that collateral did unfortunately get directed towards people, or in this case, property that was not exactly the target.
And I think it was provocateurs in some cases that did that.
Yeah, there have definitely been some arguments, especially when within like Black Bloc protester demonstrations that it's very easy for people to infiltrate those organizations just by dressing the right way, mm-hmm. or acting the right mm-hmm. way, and then acting poorly on their behalf to make the rest of them look bad, which definitely kind of lends argument towards, you know, what kind of security culture do you want to have in your labor organization or in your activist organization.
Listener, I want you, if you're listening to this, to send us your thoughts. You can do that on WOB Radio, our Facebook page, mm-hmm. or you can do that on radiotacoma.org. That's our actual website. Mm-hmm. Give us your thoughts on this, because it's not a done deal.
Absolutely. I mean, when it comes to the future of the labor movement, especially in the conversation about militancy, we are always looking towards new tactics or new approaches to making sure that we get the best wins possible with the fewest quote-unquote casualties as possible, mm-hmm. whether that's people getting laid off the job, people ending up going back to work with worse conditions in some situations. Absolutely. And I think a reason why a lot of people are looking back towards militancy is, again, because, as Gordon said, a lot of the old tactics don't work anymore. And a lot of those old tactics were developed because it benefited the businesses and it scooted the unions off to the side to the point of complacency. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, there does need to be more militancy in the labor movement. It's just, how do we want to approach this next? Which I think is a fascinating question to leave off on. Like I said, I don't think we should be bringing our AR-15s to the picket line. I obviously can't advocate for something like that, but if you're looking at labor history and you're only focusing on, say, the actual conflict of the Battle of Blair Mountain and not what led up to it, then you're missing a lot of the violence that happened to workers before it ever got to that point, mm-hmm. from a historical perspective. So, yeah, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, class consciousness. That's a key. Meaning, class consciousness means that you recognize amongst your fellow workers and amongst the working class in general that your interests are aligned. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of unions have in the past scabbed on each other, even very recently. You know, there've been unions taking over jobs or trying to take over jobs that the workforce is on strike. Well, with correct class consciousness, that won't happen, because you'll have that innate feeling of solidarity, which is why the Taft-Hartley Act outlawed secondary boycotts, outlawed sit-down strikes, outlawed, made them punishable, kind of, you know, taking the thunder out of the labor movement. And unfortunately, you know, we're not saints. You know, if somebody offers me $100,000 in a new car, you know, I might sell my fellow workers out, but with class consciousness, that's not going to happen. When the working class understands its role in changing history and changing history for the better, that's when we get true solidarity, and that's when we can get results. Even just threatening to go on strike, look what happened with the Biden administration. He's supposed to be the most pro-labor president ever, and he shut down the railroad workers before they even had a chance to go out. And so, you know, that you got to be careful about the other side of somebody's face.
And building militancy means that one day when that situation happens again, those workers can have that class consciousness and say, actually, no, we are going to go on strike in despite of labor law, mm-hmm. in despite of the people who might scab on us, in despite of the bosses who will give us even a worse deal if they try. Like, the militancy aspect is you have to be willing to take a risk for your, not just yourself, but also your fellow workers, whether that's on an assembly line or at a rail yard.
It's really all we've got.
Yes. Our labor is all that we have. Our labor value is pretty much all that our employers are trying to extract from us. And any way that we can deprive that from them up to open resistance is fair game at this point. Because, you know, if we don't stick up for each other, who's going to stick up for us?
Yeah.
Nobody.
What's that song? Without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel shall turn.
That was Ralph Chaplin. That was Solidarity Forever.
Yeah.
Well, that was what a surprise.
Yeah.
Speaking of Ralph, there's usually, I haven't heard anything this year, but there's almost always a memorial on remembrance of this Tacoma person, Ralph Chaplin. And it's usually about 10:30 in the morning, mm-hmm. at, I forget the name of the cemetery, but it's at like 74th and Lakewood Drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's here, so in South Tacoma, Ralph Chaplin's grave. Coming to the close of our roundtable discussion here, do you want to jump into our book review?
Yeah, I could give a brief report about this. I think it's an important book.
Here's fellow worker Gordon with a book review. What book did you review for this month, Gordon?
It's called Beyond the Rebel Girl, and I'll put that in perspective for the listener. For those of you who don't know, there was a song written by Joe Hill, who was executed in Utah in 1916 on a frame-up murder charge. But while he was in jail, he wrote letters to various IWW leaders. And our most famous female leader was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She was a very brave person, and usually that's the only woman, besides maybe Lucy Parsons, that I've ever heard mentioned in the IWW, which is a real shame. So this, the Rebel Girl was the name of the song that Joe Hill wrote, and he was writing it about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. But Professor Heather Meyer, who got her PhD from Simon Fraser University up in Canada, now teaches history at Portland Community College. And she was born and raised in Oregon and lives with her family in the Portland area. Well, she wrote this specific book to highlight the female leadership of the IWW right after it was formed in 1905 and through the 1920s, where the Union suffered a great setback due to the Palmer Raids and the First Red Scare. The Union was almost made extinct by the government. And several of these women, you know, traditionally when you talk about women in the labor movement, they were relegated to, since most of the workforce was male, okay, so they were relegated to subservient roles or ancillary roles. So they would form things like women's auxiliaries because they were behind strikes. They suffered when their husbands suffered. So this woman, this author has brought out some names that I had never heard of. There was a woman named Rebecca Beck. She was of German heritage, and she was from Seattle, and she got put in jail for advocating for birth control. Now, this is over 100 years ago, and just mentioning things like birth control could get a person in trouble because it was considered you were flouting the moral standards of the day. And what the author has said is that our union sought to organize all workers regardless of sex, race, or skill. It advocated organizing workers along industrial lines rather than focusing on a single craft, plant, or city. It emphasized that workers in the United States shared common interests and a common enemy with workers in Mexico, China, and Russia. All over the world, really. Another one was a woman named Louise Olivero. And then there was a female physician named Mary Equi, E-Q-U-I, and they were extremely militant. They also were advocating for birth control, which some people claim was, you know, advocating for free love, which back in the day was, you know, frowned upon, let's say. And also throughout the book, as well as illuminating the pivotal nature of some of these women leaders, she outlines that there was a respectability politics. And she says, I define respectability in this case as the upholding of white Victorian ideals of a male-dominated household and monogamous marriage, complete with child-rearing, home ownership, and modest dress and behavior. So what she is advocating, this professor was saying that these women were way out in left field in their own time. Some of them were out LGBTQ people, which was really difficult to do 100 years ago or more. Also, just the very fact of that we're going back to the dark ages now with all these state anti-abortion laws that are forcing women into unhealthy situations. It's chattel slavery. It's a return, in my view, to chattel slavery. If you don't have control over your body or over your reproductive system, what do you have control over? And so what's interesting about this author is that she draws parallels all through the book. And it's for us, it's very area specific. She talks about Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Occasionally, Montana gets into the picture. But she set the scene that the Pacific Northwest was especially ripe for union organizing, and that it wouldn't have been possible without these women leaders in pivotal roles. So it's a refreshing look at the history of, I didn't know this about my own union. I'm kind of ashamed that I didn't know about it. I got the book through the IWW store, and you can find the IWW store at the website, www.iww.org. And you just go to the little bubble that says store, and they have books, and they have, you know, merch and t-shirts and cool stuff. But the books are what I especially appreciate. I had not heard of any of these women. And also, she draws many parallels. She explains the intellectual and political ferment of the time.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH.
But basically what she's saying is that it was much more acceptable to talk about socialism. And there were socialist mayors and socialist representatives in Congress back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is very good at breaking down the seemingly rival factions, you know, between socialists, socialist workers, the communists, and the IWW gets thrown into the mix. Okay, but the IWW was and is unique in that we have a homegrown view of socialism, we have a homegrown view of what the workplace should be like, and that's worker control and management.
Through industrial unionism, yeah.
Exactly. But she's very, you know, she's very frank about some of the splits, some of the intellectual and ideological splits back in the day. So what I'm doing is I'm recommending that if you're interested in labor history, or if you're interested specifically in the history of the industrial workers of the world, and you also look at things through a feminist lens, or you look at things through the lens of racial disparities and integration on the job site, shout out to us again. We were the first union to welcome people of color and women into the rank and file of the union. It's hard to believe that...
And immigrants,
yeah.
It's pretty hard to believe that... back in the day, you couldn't even join a union. A lot of the right to exist had to be hard fought
For women,
for women and for people of color.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And it's just astonishing to me that this was by law you couldn't organize. But some of these brave women, and I know it sounds kind of trite or a cliche. But they had to be brave, because if they were treated as if either back in the day, if you weren't married, right, you were automatically suspect. You were some kind of,
you couldn't open a bank account. You couldn't get a loan.
That's it. You had to be on your own, or you had to pretty much live off the charity of strangers, right? Or unless you're independent.
Well, I want to borrow your book after you're done with them.
Oh, sure thing. Yeah, I read the whole thing. It's what our outfit out in... Bremerton is doing. We're starting a book club.
I'd also like to interject really quick.
Sure.
I think books like this are great because when we look at the history of the IWW or any other pro-working class organization like the Socialists, the Communists, the Anarchists, it's always the big names that get to the front. Like you
right.
said, mm-hmm. we think of Lucy Parsons. We think of the other woman you mentioned.
Gurley Flynn.
We see those names and we
Mother
see
Jones. Faces.
Mother Jones.
Yeah.
But we don't hear the backstory of... Who were the people behind them supporting them?
That's
you know
right.
what I mean? Like, for example, when we look at civil rights history, we almost kind of have this idea that, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did all of this on his own, when it's like, no, this is a huge coalition of
yeah.
people that all had their part to
Took
play.
A lot of ground troops to do
yeah.
that.
In order for him to even have any kind of notoriety in the first place. And the same goes for the IWW and the women in the IWW.
Indeed.
So what more do you have to offer us from this book?
Well, just the underlying spirit of allowing for women to take the lead, and to be open-minded about it, and to understand that, if I didn't have my wife or my partner at home supporting me if I went on strike, guess who'd be off the picket line real quick?
Mm-hmm. Or out of town.
Or out of or had to have to leave town. So these women understood that it was an existential threat if their husbands were being treated unfairly or not getting enough pay or working in dangerous conditions, it affected them directly. And if a guy got his arm cut off in a machine or something like that, well, guess what? That was just hard luck.
Mm-hmm.
And people, children starved because of that. And it was the women who were pivotal in focusing on the benefit of the working class in general. That's all I got.
Thank you so much for that, Philip.
What was the title of the book one more time?
It's Beyond the Rebel Girl.
And who wrote it?
Professor Heather Meyer, M-A-Y-E-R. And she's from Portland Community College.
Cool.
Yeah.
And now to give an environmental unionism report, fellow worker Marilyn.
Yeah, here I am again. Sometimes people that are involved in unions, I mean unionism, wonder what the heck the climate crisis and the environment have to do with organizing and with unionism. And I just want to remind the listener, and I tried to find who did this quote, and it's just attributed to the Earth First Movement. I couldn't find the actual author. But I think I'm going to start every environmental program with, there ain't no jobs on a dead planet.
Absolutely.
So this particular summer has been pretty hard. We had on August 8th, we had the entire city of Lahaina go up in flames with loss of life, massive loss of life, loss of property, loss of livelihoods. We had...
And history.
We had the following week on August 18th, I believe. On August 18th, we had, coincidentally, it's always been a very precious day to me. My grandson was born that day. Mm-hmm. My mother was born that day.
Wow.
Well, Toka Tai from the J-Pod of the Orcas, Pacific Northwest Orcas, 51-year-old orca whale. The tribes had been trying for years to bring her back home so she could rejoin her pod from SeaWorld in Florida. After all of these years of trying,
her mother was still alive.
They were on the home stretch of getting her home, and she died. And then on August 19th is when the Eastern Washington fires started, 15 miles north of Spokane. And many homes were destroyed. And now we have Hurricane Idalia, which just swept the coast. All of these things are happening. And we have to pay attention because there are no jobs on a dead planet, fellow workers. So the question is, and I don't ever want people to feel hopeless, although it may be, I don't know if it's too late, but we have to continue to try. When I was driving home, notice the word drive there, and I heard about Toka Tai. Something in me snapped, and I just had to pull the car over and cry. It just felt like the entire world was crumbling, and anything I could do was frivolous and useless. And it's easy. I have friends that don't try anymore. They just say, we can't save the planet. There's no hope. I'm not going to do anything. But we have to. We have to.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very short environmental report. Listener, if you're in the Tacoma area, on September 17th, there is a struggle that we need you involved in. And it will be from 4 till 7 o'clock. It is sponsored by Tacoma 350. The city of Tacoma is all set to permit another, and I can say dam on the air, another damn Amazon warehouse in Pierce County, in Tacoma. Another gigantic mega warehouse and parking lot, and they'd like to put it on top of Tacoma's aquifer. Now, it's so outrageous that I almost can't even put words to that. They have not done yet an environmental health impact study. They're saying that everything else, it's not going to affect anything.
It's just another warehouse.
This is not our only aquifer, but it's an aquifer that we're going to need as droughts continue and as the planet heats up and dries up.
It's also in one of the most polluted neighborhoods in Tacoma.
What effect will the parking lot, all the paving, have on the aquifer? I mean, do they need? Does it need to be accessed from on top, or is it going to ruin the aquifer? I don't really understand the environmental
damage. It'll be impervious.
Yeah, the aquifer won't be able to recharge from rainwater or from other groundwater.
Right.
Okay.
You'd have to wait for it to trickle in all the way from the mountains or whatever other source of natural groundwater there is.
Okay, that didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
Talk about disrespect for our planet.
Mm-hmm.
That is so disrespectful and so short-sighted. And the reason why we want a health impact study is think about the increase in giant trucks bringing stuff and taking stuff from the warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be driving through South Tacoma, several elementary schools right by it where children walk to school. They're going to be stopping at all the lights because these are local streets, polluting as they go. South Tacoma already has a poor health assessment from the health department because of the industrial pollution there. So this is economic and environmental terrorism as far as I'm concerned. So with that said, Sunday, September 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at, what is the name of that park? It's a park at 3114 South Madison Street. That's the Oakland Park. People are meeting. There will be speakers. Raging Grannies will be there singing people out. People will then go out into the neighborhoods and leaflet and talk to neighbors to educate them, if they haven't heard already, as to why they've got to get out and stop this.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a positive thing that you can do to address climate terrorism.
Chaos. Yeah.
Yeah, climate chaos in our area. And I would urge the listener to do that and get the word out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And as for those wildfires going on, I would also encourage the listeners to reach out to any verifiable organizations that they can. A lot of people are currently facing relocation assistance needs.
Right, right.
People are currently losing their homes and their cars, and a lot of these people are ending up having to stay in hotels or sometimes even homeless because of these fires.
Well, and the other thing that's going on, yes, they should help those people out and make sure it's a reputable organization. Check the Charity Navigator sites and make sure they're reputable. But be aware that the giant corporations are drooling over acquiring the land that has been burned and vacated.
As a matter of fact, within days of the Lahaina fire, residents who had their homes burned down reported that within days they had property investors trying to scalp them out of their now scorched land in an attempt to buy it for cheap, develop it, and then flip it for a profit.
Right.
And in terms of the historical context of Hawaii being a very much illegally colonized state in this country, well, a lot of it was illegally stolen, but that's a conversation too long for this episode. But in terms of what's going on in Hawaii, a lot of the indigenous locals have already been pushed out of the wealthier parts of these towns, a lot of these tourist districts. The indigenous people who lost their lands from these fires are now getting screwed out of it over harder than the people who came here more recently. It's just... And like you said, it's a terrible situation of, do I want to sell my scorched property or do I want to keep what little I have left?
Right.
It's a tough choice to make.
Who knows about the Hawaii governor's slow response? I mean,
even the president's slow response, too. I don't want to sound like any of these conservative pundits.
He hasn't declared it a disaster yet.
No.
And he hasn't declared the hurricane in Florida a disaster.
Or the hurricane off the coast of California that came before it.
Yeah. Right, right.
That's rare. A hurricane on the West Coast is something that happens every 50 to 100 years at worst.
Well, no more.
No more. Yeah.
And then Al told me this week that 3/4 of the emperor penguins in Antarctica, 3/4 of the colonies, their chicks died, all of them, because they didn't have enough ice.
Yep. They're adapted to have that year-round ice.
There ain't no jobs on a dead planet. We have to do what we can. Yes, there's no guarantee, but what choice do we have?
Also to point out about the fire in Lahaina. First of all, Lahaina was the ancient, or you know, before it got illegally colonized by a bunch of fruit plantation guys. It was the royal capital.
Right.
Lahaina was the royal capital of all of Hawaii. And another thing that was pointed out to me, I think it was in Jacobin magazine, mm-hmm. that it was the sugar plantations that altered the natural landscape.
Right.
They used to have forests, and the forests got cleared so that they could plant sugar. And that led directly, just like here in the mainland, we were so into fire suppression, and we paid no attention to the Native American practices of setting fires deliberately so that you could clear out the undergrowth and clear out all the fuel so the big trees could survive. Well, the same kind of deal happens when they turn forest land into agricultural land. And they did that to Lahaina and the island of Maui. And it was turned into a sugar plantation, essentially. And so these natural controls were gone. And just another thing to be, you know, when we say we like to organize on the job site, we like to organize the working class. But as Marilyn has so abundantly pointed out, there ain't no jobs on a dead planet. But also, when we do these things, when we do make agricultural land, I'm not saying that we shouldn't eat, you know, but there are sustainable practices like intercropping. And yes, you can't get the maximum amount of profit out of it. And that's the only reason why you see these vast, you know, monoculture fields in the United States. Nothing but corn as far as the eye can see, you know, without any natural. What was the three crops at the Native
corn,
Americans?
Corn, beans, and squash.
That's it. And they supported each other. I mean, like literally, the corn also supported the bean stalks.
They were the three sisters, and they still are.
Yeah, and they could grow sustainably together. But that makes it awful hard for a combine to plow through a 100 acres of field in one day. But that's the point, ain't it? The point is that we want production for use, not production for profit. And environmentally sustainable practices are the future.
Yeah, I would advise the reader, if they can get their hands on this month's copy of Yes Magazine, mm-hmm. the whole issue is dedicated to the concept of growth. What is growth? Is all growth good? Is all growth bad? What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there are many ways they look at growth. Farming is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think
growing community is another one.
To throw in a couple points here, you know, I think you make a great point that not all growth is good, to kind of answer that question. Like when we talk about a growth in profits or an expansion of industry, we're often talking about, you know, larger businesses developing their assets specifically for the profit, especially when it comes to things like monocropping and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's growth. There's, you know, more corn being produced and there's a bigger profit margin being made on that. But at the end of the day, it's like just because you cannot indefinitely grow on a limited planet.
But growth in relationships and in community, that's a different thing.
Yes, it is. And also to kind of bounce off of Gordon and throw my thoughts in here for a sec. You know, the history of colonialism and how that translates to its environmental impact, especially on a location like Hawaii. You know, like you said, a lot of that monocropping and a lot of that land development it killed off a whole host of native species.
Sure.
I'm sure all of you have heard that historic recording of the one of the tropical birds that was native to Hawaii, the last recording of them singing before they went extinct in the 60s.
Was that the nene?
I believe it was, yeah. It was a recording of the last male mating call before it passed away. You know, the history of colonialism tied into the environmental impact that has had, whether that's something as big as a continent like North America or something as small as a chain of islands such as Hawaii, like, there's a fascinating research and literature about that I highly advise the listener into, because the colonization of times past have come to directly affect land use, development, resource acquisition, how we get those resources, how we treat the planet, what kind of sustainable practices are we putting in? How are those sustainable practices even being framed? Exactly. So,
listener, if you have any ideas for ways that we can address climate chaos and the need to continue at this point to work for money to earn our livings, we would love to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
And write us or
shoot us a message on Facebook. You can write out, you can send an email to the branch, the Tacoma IWW branch, which is available on our Facebook page.
Yeah, we're all on this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
And I'd like to say that people around the world should be in close communication with the indigenous people wherever they are. They know how to care for the earth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Really.
The IWW has a great history of organizing alongside indigenous workers. There was a famous dock workers union up in Vancouver, BC in the early years of the IWW that was almost entirely Coast Salish peoples, mm-hmm. because a lot of them were dock workers and a lot of them found a lot of solidarity from their experiences of colonization. Yeah.
I love that, you know, during slavery, so many of the African slaves and the black slaves were working on the land. And so when they were freed, quote, a lot of them, after Jim Crow laws came back in, ended up working as sharecroppers on the land. So working on the land kind of became a dirty word because you couldn't make any money. You could barely exist. It was a form of slavery. Then landowners would come in and push them off the land, the few farmers that were left. So black people were pretty much dispossessed from the land and living in cities. But what's happening now is there is a movement of urban blacks and agricultural blacks, or what's the other word?
People of color.
Rural. I'm thinking urban and rural. Of rural people of color, but specifically blacks,
mm-hmm.
Coming back and getting reacquainted with the concept of land.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't used to be safe to go out in the woods. You might get lynched. Now they're starting to actually go out and hike and enjoy this land.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're starting to actually garden again and farm again. And I love that they're reclaiming the land. And their practices are small farm practices. They're not the big industrial types of production.
They're also farming in accordance to what the land can sustain, how the nutrient cycle works with what they're growing.
And urban farmers that are gardening on rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are wonderful, that's in Detroit specifically.
Mm-hmm. Rain gardens are being introduced in different areas.
So there are points of optimism and points of light.
Absolutely. And I think in the context of environmental unionism, bringing it back to the IWW, a lot of what we try to focus on when we talk about environmental unionism is how do we organize the job site? Yes, but also depending on what job site you're working at, how can we incorporate better sustainable practices for this business as members of the rank and file and the workers so that the business can be as sustainable as possible, so that the industry can be healthy.
And that's where you have to be militant too. Sometimes you have to stand up and demand better environmental conditions.
Absolutely.
Better environmental production and better environmental safeguards for the workers.
Speaking to that point, I just read an article, I believe it was in These Times, I might have that wrong, but it was about what's going on in Africa, okay, and how the Green Revolution type people were trying to introduce those old concepts, in other words, chemical fertilizers, industrial scale farming.
Yeah, they call themselves green. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're greenwashing themselves.
Yeah.
But the original Green Revolution was a good thing, mm-hmm. you know, because the guy increased crop yields. He was a scientist, he was an agronomist. But it became, naturally, it got distorted through the lens of profit. And so what happened just recently is that basically the Green Revolution folks were kicked out of Africa.
Good.
Because they were bringing fewer yields.
That's been happening in India for a bunch of years.
I know.
Now, all of Africa or just one or two countries?
Several countries in Africa.
Okay.
Where this model of industrial agriculture was being laid on them. Like, this is the only way you can do it.
Well, the World Bank loved it.
Well, yeah, and IMF and all those guys.
Yeah.
So, but the point is that they've taken, just like what's been happening recently politically in West Africa, what used to be French West Africa,
mm-hmm.
they are kicking out these autocratic families that have basically been working hand in glove with France and with the United States. So I was very pleased to see that. Yeah, they're not making mega profits, but what they're doing is that they're reintroducing native crops like millet and sorghum instead of corn and wheat, you know, because that's a very, very European and American viewpoint of what
what good food is.
And it brings it back to what Marilyn said earlier, that just because something is growing or something's developing, it's good. And in this context, it's about, do we want to export our practices of monocropping to other parts of the world?
I think not.
do we want to encourage the people of that part of the world to continue with the crop methods they know can survive?
Right. How much profit is enough?
Exactly. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Come back to me.
All right. But yeah, no. Any closing thoughts before we wrap up environmental unionism?
Show up on September 17th.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
This is just a tangential thought, but cultivating rice takes many people. Mm-hmm. Cultivating wheat takes some machinery, or, you know, very few people.
A good point.
And that has to do with our cultures. That's partly how the cultures developed in the East and the West, we could say. I found that a pretty interesting concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, if there's anything I can encourage our fellow listeners and fellow workers, keep your eyes and ears out for, you know, whatever environmental activism you can contribute to. As I've, you know, I keep hyping up Andreas Malm, but, you know, I think it is time that we reorganize and we take back into account other methods of protest or getting our information across, things like that.
Speaking of which, mm-hmm. Winona LaDuke will be heading back to court today. She was one of several women that were arrested trying to stop the number 3 pipeline that goes through their rice fields and their territory. Mm-hmm. Keep your eye out and stay informed about what happens with her trial.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If we do participate in environmental action groups, it's good to show up as a union member. Wear your t-shirt, wear your hat, because the environmental movement and the labor movement have been artificially separated.
They should be
for
really
they should
good
be
friends.
Working hand in glove, because, you know, well, look at all the train wrecks and everything like that.
Yeah.
Directly related to the environment. So show up and show up as a union member.
Well, and one more thing, one last little thing. I just want to bring the listeners' attention to the fact that Veterans for Peace, what they've been focusing on locally here, is stopping the incredible waste and the havoc to the environment that the Blue Angels cause. Hmm. We spend, I think it's $163,000 a minute.
Jesus.
To send those jets up. And all they do is pollute and make a lot of noise. And for what? For recruiting. We mm-hmm. don't need it.
Absolutely.
I got a question before we leave the topic.
Yes?
Are we still burning coal
to
make electricity?
In several states, yes.
To keep our air conditioners going?
Mm-hmm.
Biggest open
Think
pit.
Think about it.
Biggest open pit. I drove over it. The highway goes right through this huge... I looked out the window and it was
Where?
Just black. Wyoming.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just a huge open pit mine, and then there's a coal-fired plant right there. So, yes.
To run our air conditioner.
Yeah. There you got it. Makes
you got
sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally.
All right. So, to close out the show today, I'd just like to give some recommendations of where we get our labor news. This is something that we've kind of covered in the past couple episodes because we want to encourage our listeners to be informed on these topics. We recognize that our WAB radio show, we can only make an episode a month, but we want you to keep on top of these labor stories as they develop. Obviously, things that happen within organized labor. Sometimes a year can happen in a week. Sometimes something that should have happened in a week might take a year. So we definitely recommend Northwest Labor Press.
The Jacobin.
The Jacobin in these times is also a great mm-hmm. outlet as well. Obviously, we have the IWW publications. We have the Industrial Worker, which you can also find on IWW.org. We also have the Seattle Worker, which I'm a part of. It's a wonderful local publication, a newspaper produced by the Seattle branch of the IWW that does a lot of local labor news and
350.org, Seattle and Tacoma branches.
Absolutely. And we also recommend reaching out through the Tacoma DSA. They certainly need more help coming up to the upcoming local election with the Homeowner for All initiative. Yes, Phil?
How do you spell Jacobin?
Jacobin. Also, Citizens Climate Lobby.
Mm-hmm. Also, The Stand, which comes out of the State Labor Council.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, you check out these websites, check out these sources of media. Because
and Radio Tacoma. At 101.9 FM.
Mm-hmm. As well as 95.3 KTQA. And for all of our Bellingham listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. That would be KZAX 94.9 in downtown. We really appreciate all of your listenership. Even whether that's 100 people tuning in a week or 1,000 people tuning in a week, we're just happy to produce radio that is by and for the working class and for those workers who want to be organized within our union. So, and we just want to thank all of our fellow listeners for tuning in to WOB Radio. We look forward to you tuning in next month as we produce another episode. Solidarity forever.
Solidarity, everybody.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.
Solidarity forever.